Good Friday. We look back at the accord that bears its name. Also today, a new type of social media opens up in Iran, and a frank discussion follows.
You had people from all sorts of political stripes listening, which I think led to this sense of novelty.
And we hear why Aaron Sorkin tackled Vietnam War protests in his latest film.
I like writing idealistically and romantically. I like writing about heroes who don't wear capes. They don't have superpowers. They're people trying to do the right thing.
And in West Africa, some women are being kept in camps accused of being witches.
They are stripped of their dignity. They are turned into monsters. They are literally stripped of their own land.
Now the women are telling their side through music. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories on the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today on this Friday before Easter. Palestinian Christians singing in the Old City of Jerusalem on this Good Friday. The crowds are bigger than last year as coronavirus restrictions are loosening up in the Holy Land. Good Friday marks another anniversary in Northern Ireland when bitter enemies signed a peace agreement 23 years ago today.
Good evening. A historic day at Stormont. After 2 years of talks and after a generation of bloodshed and decades of division and acrimony.
The 1998 Good Friday Agreement helped end decades of violence between Catholics and Protestants, known as the Troubles. Leaders on both sides of the sectarian divide in Northern Ireland signed it, as well as the heads of state of the Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom.
The principle of consent is absolute and is throughout the agreement.
Standing alongside Tony Blair that day was the Irish Prime Minister, Bertie Ahern.
My ultimate political aspiration remains the coming together of all the people of Ireland, achieved peacefully and by consent.
These days, Bertie Ahern says the Good Friday Agreement he helped hammer out accomplished a lot, but that Brexit is shaking the very foundations of the accord.
The Good Friday Agreement did many positive things. You know, we got the institutions of government up in Northern Ireland, the election of the Assembly, the Executive. We certainly sorted out the violence. There's been no violence of any magnitude over the last 20 years or so. But unfortunately, in 2016, when Brexit happened, it created the situation that the border between the European Union and Northern Ireland became the European border. So for the last 20 years, we've had no border, we've no customs border, we've no security border. Everything has been freewheeling. Those of us in the Republic of Ireland, obviously, were opposed to a border across Ireland, again, dividing the country. But the form of Brexit that the British government negotiated meant there had to be a border somewhere. And then they decided that was down the Irish Sea. So, of course, it's a border in name, it's a border in there's no line. This is what's caused the problem, Carl, and this has created a lot of instability and uncertainty and antagonism, and it's not too hard to stir these things up, but it's been very unhelpful.
In fact, the Protestant loyalist paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland announced just a few weeks ago that they're withdrawing support for the Good Friday Agreement to protest Northern Ireland's Irish Sea trade border.
I don't think they're threatening violence, and I don't think anyone wants to go back to that. But it has created a lot of agitation. But I have to say to your listeners, Carol, it is the form of Brexit that Boris Johnson finally settled on. Theresa May, when she was Prime Minister, wanted Northern Ireland and the rest of Great Britain to remain as part of the single market and the customs unit of the European Union. And if that had happened, this issue wouldn't have arose. Boris Johnson, when he came in 2 years ago, set his mind totally against that. He didn't want anything to do with the single market in England, Scotland or Wales. It is the structure of the deal that he negotiated and has caused the difficulty, and it's continued to create a lot of agitation.
And that's really a non-negotiable fact.
It is, unless they can find some magical way of, there is no border, you know, there is no line down the sea. It is in your head. But what happens is the paperwork has to be treated when goods come in. It has to be treated as that they're being checked in the ports, checking the airports. The one thing we all agree with in Ireland is if Brexit never happens, we believe it's a disaster, but the people are entitled to make a decision in the United Kingdom.
The Protestant loyalist groups in Northern Ireland, they're withdrawing support in response to this sea border. Will there ever be a hard border or a physical border across Irish land instead?
No. Irish republicanism, Irish nationalism, and I think probably about 99% of the population will never tolerate that again. Now, whether they can find some modification that helps to deal with this Northern Ireland Protocol, I don't know.
You've said you think there should be a referendum on unification in Ireland on the 30th anniversary of the Good Friday Accord. Why such a distant timeline?
It can't happen now because there's still a lot of instability. The institutions of Northern Ireland have been up and down over the last 5 or 6, 10 years. So you have to get stability first. You have to have the planning done for what a new Ireland would look like. And we're light years away from that. Unfortunately, Carol, there's very little work done on how a new Ireland would look like. I mean, how would you amalgamate the justice system? How would you amalgamate the police forces? There's an enormous amount of mechanics.
But do you think a united Ireland is achievable, but just not in the short term?
Yeah, I think it is achievable. We tend to say now, Carla, a new Ireland, to make it attractive enough for the unionists and loyalist people. So a new Ireland is where we would probably have a new constitution, where we would negotiate and agree things between us. It might mean new flags, new emblems, new anthems, to make it a comfortable place for those people that want to see themselves as being British.
Finally, if you don't mind, I'm hoping you can take us back to 1998 to look at some of the sacrifices that were made to get to this deal. I know that at a crucial stage of the negotiations, your mother passed away and you quickly drove back to Dublin for the funeral and then went straight back up again to continue negotiations. I'm sure others made different sorts of personal sacrifices. What ultimately brought the negotiators like yourself and bitter foes together?
I think everyone had to compromise. All of the parties had to move from their position. Northern Ireland isn't a very big place, but the political representatives didn't talk to each other. They wouldn't debate on the airways with each other. The bitterness and almost hatred, Carl, were very much in evidence. So you're trying to bring together not only opposing sides who had political or ideological difference of views, but people who were extremely divorced from each other in every way. And they all had to make, you know, sacrifices.
What did it take to get to that level? What finally moved people to hammer these things out?
A lot of hours of banging heads, I think, Carl. We worked on the basis that nothing was agreed until everything was agreed. And I always describe it as the three legs of the stool. And there were kind of leg one was how things would happen within Northern Ireland. The second leg of the stool was the relationship between Northern Ireland, Belfast and Dublin. And the third one was the relationship between Dublin and London. And that's really got us through the last 23 years. Personally, I would like to see it work far better. I think there's a lot of things that could be done to improve it.
Did personal chemistry between the negotiators play a role?
I did, yeah. I think Tony Blair and I had built up a relationship before we started negotiations. We worked together rather than it being Ireland against England, which is the way it's been for about 800 years. And it's a bit that way again, I'm afraid, Carl. But we managed to work together. There were very good people. A lot of them have left us, unfortunately, to their eternal rewards. So we think of all of them today. But, you know, we had a good group of people together. Now, that didn't take away from the abuse and straight talking. But as I learned to my experience and sometimes my horror, the people in Northern Ireland can be very blunt and very straight, but it's better to do it that way. At least everything is put on the table.
That's former Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern. He played a key role in negotiating the Good Friday Accords. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Carol. And you mind yourself and have a good Easter.
A big diplomatic breakthrough today. The US and Iran have agreed to discuss the 2015 nuclear deal through intermediaries. Iranian officials online have been holding other kinds of conversations too. This week, Foreign Minister Javad Zarif spent hours on an app called Clubhouse. He discussed everything from Iran's recent partnership with China to his bedtime routine. The Royal Shirin Jafari reports.
Roughly 8,000 people joined the discussion, the maximum number that Clubhouse allows. The foreign minister spoke for more than an hour. Mahsa Ali Mardani joined the discussion. She studies at Oxford University, focusing on political communications in Iran.
All of a sudden, people have the opportunity to be engaged in questions and answers with him. And if you were following any Persian social media, suddenly this was blowing up.
Ali Mardani says these types of encounters with high-level Iranian officials are extremely rare.
You had people from all sorts of political stripes from in the diaspora and from inside of Iran listening, which I think led to this sense of novelty.
There's a sense of novelty because in Iran, the state controls the media. It filters the internet and blocks most social media apps. But here was the foreign minister showing a somewhat unvarnished side of himself. At one point, Zarif complained that it was way past his bedtime. The moderator pleaded with him to stay a little longer. This audio, by the way, was made public by the Iranian state media. But Zarif had his talking points too. He said he wanted to put an end to rumors that he's planning to run for president in the upcoming election in June. He also wanted to respond to allegations made against him in a TV show. The show claims that during the nuclear talks with the U.S., Zarif's team had been infiltrated by spies. These are lies, he said. The majority of the questions from Clubhouse participants were about the new and controversial deal between Iran and China. Some Iranians are outraged that their government kept details of the deal secret. Clubhouse only allows the moderator to choose who can ask a question, so it wasn't like anybody could jump in at any time. Afterwards, in another session that went on until early hours of the morning, the moderator admitted that the foreign ministry had asked him to follow government protocols. Still, Amir Rashidi, who has studied Iran's internet for the past decade, says Clubhouse has opened up a new space for political debate among Iranians.
Clubhouse is actually changing the way that we talk to each other, changing the way that we are connecting to each other.
Rashidi is keeping an eye on who joins Clubhouse in Iran. He says in the past few months, he's noticed a rise in the number of politicians and public figures who are embracing the platform. Even though the app only runs on Apple devices, Rashidi says Iranians have found workarounds, like they always do.
Iranians are usually tech savvy. If you ask my mom, what's the best circumvention tool, filter she can, she would definitely have at least five options for you.
Circumvention tools like VPNs help people bypass internet censorship. Both Rashidi and Ali Mardani are cautious about making too much of this Clubhouse phenomenon or suggesting that it could bring democracy to Iran. Here's Ali Mardani.
I kept on being reminded of the same media fascination there was with Trump that actually fed into his power, which is, you know, you can't stop watching. It's so entertaining. And the more you watch, the more you feed into the system and buying into their spectacle.
Sina Azadi, a political commentator in Washington, says it's no coincidence that this event comes in the run-up to the Iranian election.
There is a propaganda war in the West, East, and Iranians are trying to use these media platforms to send their own message.
Azadi expects more of these seemingly impromptu appearances by politicians in Iran in the coming months. And that makes Amir Rashidi concerned. He says Clubhouse should work with local experts to make sure that the Iranian state doesn't use the app to crack down on dissent.
They can have a better understanding and better model to basically form their tools in a way that protects human rights, protects freedom of speech, protects people's privacy and security.
But that might not even be necessary, because Clubhouse could soon end up on the long list of social media apps that are blocked in Iran. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Amazon workers in Alabama are waiting to find out if they'll be unionizing. Employees there are part of a growing global push for more workers' rights. That's reflected in some international trade agreements as well, including the deal that replaced NAFTA, called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. The USMCA, as it's known, now allows migrant workers from Mexico to more easily file complaints. The World's Daisy Contreras has more.
Adareli Ponce has tried for the last 20 years getting a visa to work at farms in the U.S.
Y desgraciadamente lo que me decía, ¿no? Es que tú eres mujer y para mujeres no hay oportunidad y no hay oportunidad. Entonces, me llega una oportunidad.
But she says, time after time, farm labor recruiters in Mexico told her farm work is better for men. Ponce instead got an H-2B visa. That's for workers at factory jobs in the U.S. The pay is much less than farm labor. Ponce left her home state of Hidalgo in central Mexico to work at a Louisiana chocolate factory during some seasons, like Easter and Valentine's Day. All of her co-workers were women, she says, sorting and packing chocolates in the assembly lines. The men were stacking boxes and earning more, she says.
Nos defendimos y después de ahí pues, nos dijeron que nosotras éramos mujeres problemáticas y que ya no nos querían más ahí.
Ponce and other women spoke out, she says, asking for better pay, better treatment, and more opportunities to do the same work as their male co-workers. But they say they were labeled as problematic and were not hired again. That was years ago. Last summer, Ponce and more than a dozen workers' rights groups saw an opportunity. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, replaced the decades-old North American Free Trade Agreement. With it came new labor rules allowing workers to file complaints directly with each government. Ponce says she wants both countries to take a hard look at the gender-based issues migrant workers face. She and another female worker submitted a petition in March. They're alleging gender discrimination during the recruitment process in Mexico and pay discrimination in the U.S. Gaspar Rivera Salgado is with the UCLA Labor Center. He says labor complaints to the U.S. under NAFTA were not successful. That's because clear guidelines didn't exist. Now, he says, under the new agreement, Ponce's allegations could set a win for labor, if it succeeds.
This is a test of how this is going to work in the U.S. side, to test the limits of that agreement, and especially because at the core of the agreement is the recognition of international non-discriminatory standards.
Ponce and other advocates are also calling for an independent investigation. Rivera Salgado says whatever comes from that could help the U.S., Mexico, and Canada pinpoint changes to their agreement.
Trade agreements are very difficult political processes in the three countries, and it takes a long time.
The U.S. government, however, can take other steps, says Melanie Stratton Lopez. She's an attorney with Centro Derechos del Migrante. It's a nonprofit working on labor issues in Mexico and the U.S. The group is also backing Ponce's petition. Stratton Lopez says workers like Ponce with H-2B visas are treated differently from workers on other visas, who often have free legal access in case they run into problems with their employers. The H-2B visa holders don't have that access.
And so that's something that really should change. You have workers that are very vulnerable, that are often in rural areas, and then they are by law excluded from accessing free legal services.
As for Adareli Ponce, she's looking ahead. Even though she's back living in the Mexican state of Hidalgo, she says she's in the process of applying for another worker's visa. This time, she says, she's hopeful she'll get to work at a farm. And she has several friends hoping for the same thing, too.
Ese es nuestro sueño, pues quisiéramos que fuera H2A, pero si no se puede, pues H2B está bien. El chiste es ir y trabajar.
That's our dream, she says, to get a farm worker's visa and earn more. But if not, she says the point is to go and work. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
The Biden administration has called the war in Yemen the biggest humanitarian crisis in the world. Earlier this week, for one small community there, this crisis has led to deportation. The Houthis, an Iranian-backed group who control most of northern Yemen and the capital city Sana'a, expelled 13 Yemeni Jews from their homes. Now there are less than 10 Jews remaining in all of Yemen. We're joined now by Dov Levitan. He's a professor at Ashkelon College in Israel, and he's an expert on Israel's Yemenite community. Professor Levitan, why were these 13 Jews expelled by the Houthis?
Well, the first reason is that simply the Houthis wanted to get rid of them. They don't want any more Jews in Yemen. We have to remember that they are cooperating with Iran. The attitude of the leadership of Iran towards Jews is not very positive. The second reason is maybe those Jews who wanted to stay in Yemen for so many years got the conclusion that they have no future and they didn't actually have any choice but to leave the country.
Did these 13 Jews who were expelled by the Houthis, was it related to the case of a Jewish prisoner in Yemen, Levi Salam Musa Mahabi? I know he's been in prison there for several years.
Yeah, for about 5-6 years. Well, he has been helping to smuggle out very rare Torah scroll, which was written on the skin of a deer. The Houthis were very upset about it. According to the last testimony we got from these 13 people who already left Yemen, they told that that was the only way that they could get this Jew out of the jail.
Right now, there are only a handful of Jews left in Yemen, less than 10. Yemen used to have a Jewish population of around 50,000. Is there a 1-minute version of the history of the Jewish Yemeni community?
According to most historians, Jews have lived in Yemen for the last 2,000 years. They were some kind of outsiders. They were from time to time oppressed. They were allowed to work only in certain professions, but they were allowed also to maintain their religious life. And the Jews of Yemen stick to Judaism for 2,000 years, almost without any interruption. They always dreamed about immigrating back to the land of Israel.
And once Israel, the Jewish state, was established, many thousands of Yemeni Jews migrated there, didn't they?
Right. Almost all of the 50,000 Jews came with an airlift, also known as the magic carpet, which started already in the end in December 48 and continued in 49 and 50, but mainly in 49. By the way, the parents of my wife and some of her brothers and sisters came with that airlift, and only about 1,700 Jews were left in Yemen. And also the major part of them left. And then the last Jews staying there were those families who actually came or had to leave Yemen this week.
That's an amazing story. When you heard this news about some of the last Jews being expelled from Yemen, did it feel like it was the end of an era, the end of an ancient Jewish community in Yemen that had lived there for hundreds and hundreds of years?
Yes, yes. And especially for me as a historian who has been dealing with it, yes, this is a historical event. It's so important for Jewish history as well as the history of the Jewish life in Yemen, because that's the end. I mean, there will be no continuation of Jewish life in Yemen anymore.
Dov Levitan is a professor at Ashkelon College in Israel. He's been talking to us about the deportation of some of the last Jews of Yemen. Thank you very much.
Thank you for hosting me.
You're listening to The World. When things get tense between migrants and people in their adopted nations, sometimes a game of kickball can help.
In this game, you don't have to run after a ball all the time, so there's more time to socialize.
How some Venezuelans and Colombians are learning to get along. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The fighting in the Tigray region of northern Ethiopia continues, but we're beginning to see reports showing the extent of the civilian costs of the war. New research from a team at Belgium's University of Ghent shows nearly 2,000 people have been killed in more than 150 massacres. Jan Niessen is a geography professor who is leading the investigation. Professor Niessen, before we get to your report, how does a geographer end up reporting on casualties in a war?
I'm also not only a geographer, I am also working in Tigray since almost 30 years. So I know so many people there. I have a small house over there. So I know so many people who are affected by the war.
The numbers you're reporting on are really staggering.
Where we do not always have the names of the people, but among the people killed, 2,000, we could fully identify them and how they were killed.
How do you identify the dead and where do you get your data?
We have a lot of friends on the ground and they are telephoning around, collecting data for us.
How do you go about identifying the dead?
We are getting what people are telling us. We are trying to triangulate when other people talk about the same person, where he was killed, in which conditions he was killed. But we don't have a photo of the dead person.
But you are identifying the dead, their names and who they are.
Yes, we are identifying how they were killed, which date they were killed. And so that later on, hopefully, when all these war crimes will be investigated, we can help for that.
One of your colleagues has been tweeting the names of the victims, nearly 2,000, one name at a time. Is there one you can tell us about?
For example, we have Priest Yemane. He is number 318 on the list. And Priest Yemane is in one village where we are having been doing a lot of research. Priest Yemane was hosting our students every year almost in his house. So we knew him quite close. And what happened with them? They were in a small village that's called Adikoilo, maybe 3 kilometers away from the road. They were searching for leaders of the Tigray government. So they terrorized the people. Tell us where is Debrecen. Tell us where is Getacho. But these people, they don't know. Tigray is big, twice as Belgium. And then they killed the priest to terrorize the village.
So you're saying the Ethiopian soldiers were looking for the Tigrayan leaders, and that's where some of these killings took place?
Yes, and then they killed the people to terrorize them. The other killing, very typical, is when they lose a battle.
So far, based on your research, which group is responsible for the most killings? Is it the Eritrean army, the Ethiopian army? Who?
According to our data, it is the Eritrean. 43% ascertained by our spokespeople that they are killed by Eritrean people. 18% are killed by Ethiopian soldiers. And then 18% the people don't know because the Eritreans, and they moved out. When they came back, they found the killed people, and they don't know if it were the Eritreans or the Ethiopians who did it.
Is there a repeated set of circumstances that you're coming across when people describe what happened? Is there a pattern to these killings? Who's doing them? How they're done? Who's targeted?
Anybody can be targeted. Yeah, sometimes there are priests, like I was saying, then it is like setting an extent, terrorizing. If we do this to the priest, we are afraid for nothing, something. Even God cannot do anything to stop us. That's a bit the message. People are very religious over there. But they can pick anybody. One of their targets nowadays are the relatives of militia people. If they suspect in one house that the man has fled to the mountains to be with the Tigray forces as a fighter, they can kill that whole household that is there. So that's one pattern. Another pattern is revenge when they lose a battle. And another pattern is extracting information.
So extracting information, revenge over a particular battle, and then targeting people who they think are linked to the Tigray militia, to the Tigray special forces.
Yeah.
Jan, what do you expect you'll recognize of Tigray when you go back?
What can I Well, I will recognize the people. Yeah, and I know the people are very tough. I mean, tough in terms of, you know, what they did. I was there since they started rebuilding that after a civil war with Derg, and they were able to reconstruct it. So I feel they will be able to reconstruct it again. So I'll find back a dire condition, but people who will build it up again.
Jan Niessen is a professor at the University of Ghent in Belgium. His team is documenting the civilian war deaths in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Thank you so much for talking about this.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Taiwan is facing its worst rail disaster in decades. Early this morning, a passenger train hit a truck. The train then derailed while traveling through a tunnel along Taiwan's east coast. According to authorities, the truck's emergency brake was not properly engaged and likely slid down a hillside onto the tracks from a nearby worksite above. The crash left at least 50 people dead and more than 100 injured. Much of the train was still inside the tunnel when the collision occurred, forcing passengers to climb out of the train's windows and onto the roof to escape. This is video taken at the scene by local news outlet Hualien Speedy News. Rescue workers are helping people climb down the outside of the train from the roof to the ground, some still holding luggage. The train had been very crowded, so crowded that many passengers had reportedly been forced to stand. Many of the passengers were getting ready for the first day of a long holiday weekend in Taiwan, the annual Tomb Sweeping Festival. It's an important holiday in Taiwan where people travel to their hometowns to pay respects at the graves of family members. They clean off the grave sites of their loved ones and burn offerings. Many people on board were believed to be on their way to do just that. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen sent her condolences today to the families of those who died and said there will be an investigation of the incident. At the site of the crash, members of a Buddhist humanitarian organization worked at an aid tent, treating minor wounds and offering lunches as rescuers wheeled out passengers on stretchers. They also sang and prayed. What's fact? What's fiction? Many movies blur a bit of both. The latest example, the Oscar-nominated film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven.
I, Bobby G. Seale, have a motion pro se to defend myself. I'd like to invoke the precedent of Adams versus U.S. ex rel McCann, where the Supreme Court...
All right, that's enough. Where are you learning these things?
I like writing idealistically and romantically. I like writing about heroes who don't wear capes. They don't have superpowers. They're people trying to do the right thing.
That's filmmaker Aaron Sorkin describing his latest film. You know Sorkin's name from The West Wing and many other political and legal dramas. He's this week's guest on The Economist Asks, a podcast from our partners at Economist Radio. Anne McElvoy is the host and joins me now from London. Anne, I've seen The Trial of the Chicago Seven. The film, of course, is about the group of Vietnam anti-war protesters who were arrested and charged with trying to incite a riot at the 1968 Democratic Convention. Its release is uncanny because there's strange parallels between 1968 and the storming of the Capitol building back in January. What did Sorkin have to say about the timing of this film's release?
Well, it was very interesting, Carol, that he'd worked for so long and clearly been badgering Steven Spielberg to get on and make this film as the two of them had started out on the journey together. And then he said as the Trump administration got into its swing, and there was one particular statement that Donald Trump made about missing the days when rabble-rousing protesters could be kind of roughed off and shoved in the back of a van, and that was the tone of that. And the message of that really troubled him. And I think that was why it felt so important to him to get on and make it.
Aaron Sorkin took liberties in his film about the Chicago Seven and events in the courtroom. That blurring of lines between fact and fiction that I mentioned earlier, how does he thread that needle? I mean, where does he see his role as a filmmaker?
I challenged him quite a lot on the blend of fact and fiction in the movie, because there are just various points which things happen which would have happened in a different sequence. Maybe someone else would have said the words, or there would have been other material you could have added. His reply to me was really interesting. It was that his job wasn't to dramatize a Wikipedia page. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, but it does then raise the question of how much historical political drama is fact and how much it is something which isn't exactly fake news, but it's a bit of a twist or it's a spiral into something where the audience has to figure out what really happened and what's interpretation.
We have a clip from the movie and it does need a little setup here. The him Sorkin is referring to is the late Tom Hayden, one of the protesters on trial, who in the film reads the names of Vietnamese and Americans who were killed in the Vietnam War. He reads them out in the courtroom, but that didn't really happen.
Something like it happened in the sense that these names were read out in the courtroom. They were read earlier in the trial by someone else. So that's a little bit of a sleight of hand.
If you have him also reading names of North Vietnamese soldiers, if you do it earlier in the trial, if you have Dellinger do it, none of that much more important truth lands. You've done a journalistically accurate version of the trial of the Chicago Seven, which is basically dramatizing a Wikipedia page. It's just not what I wanted to do with the story. There are things I wouldn't dream of changing for any reason. And there are things I have no problem working with as a dramatist without feeling like I'm perverting history at all.
Dellinger, who he referred to as David Dellinger, who was one of the anti-war protesters on trial. But I'm wondering, did Sorkin talk about the purpose of all this?
Yes, I think his point was, how do you make a film that is about 1968 that doesn't come across as a kind of costume drama, sort of Mad Men with politics thrown in, if you like, and still says something to today without trying to force those comparisons? And remember, of course, this is a democratically led city at the time. It's all happening under Mayor Daley. It didn't need Donald Trump for that to happen. But at the same time, there are clear commonalities, there are threads, and the things we should still be very worried about. And I think that's why he's making the defense that he's making, that he can bend and massage a bit. But it does make for a really fascinating conversation, because I think people will have different cases where they think that's okay with me, and others where they raise an eyebrow or think, didn't really happen that way. Makes for a very interesting movie. I think it makes for a very interesting conversation around it too.
What most surprised you, Anne, in your conversation with Aaron Sorkin?
He said something about The West Wing which really landed with me. I said I still had the old tapes. I have to say mine is still on video to an extent. It shows how long I've been watching it. And he said, I could make it now. I think it would still be really interesting now, but the audience would be completely divided and I would never be able to bring together the kind of coalition in the audience which enjoyed The West Wing. So that would simply be impossible now. The audience would be divided down the middle, red, blue, and pro and con. So he really felt that those days were gone. I think he's still very proud of The West Wing, happy that a lot of us are still watching it, but he didn't think he could make it now.
Huh. Anne McElvoy, host of The Economist, asks. You can listen to more of Anne's conversation with filmmaker Aaron Sorkin on the podcast The Economist Asks. Anne, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
In just the past 2 weeks alone, more than 5,000 Venezuelans have fled over the border into Colombia. They're trying to escape fighting between drug trafficking groups and a special force of the Venezuelan army. An estimated 1.8 million Venezuelan migrants and refugees are now in Colombia, and anti-immigrant sentiment is growing there. That's led groups working with migrants to try out new ways to make integration a bit smoother. They're finding that sometimes having a little childish fun goes a long way. Manuel Rueda has more from the Colombian border town of Riohacha.
Marisabel Parra whacks a soccer ball with her right foot and rushes for first base. Playing kickball in this dusty field on the outskirts of Riohacha helps the 21-year-old deal with some of the stress that comes with being an unemployed migrant, and also brings back memories of her home country. It reminds me of my childhood in Venezuela, when I used to play this at school and in the streets, she says. Add in that it's a good way to meet people and kill time. The organizers of this kickball league in the city of Riohacha hope the sport can facilitate integration between Venezuelan migrants like Maria Isabel and their new neighbors, as anti-immigrant sentiment grows around the country.
La nacionalidad. Pero hoy estamos todos en una cancha.
Our message to young people is that it doesn't matter where you come from, says Jairo Ibarra from the Brisas del Norte Foundation, the community group that started the kickball league. We're all in the same field now, and we must learn to live together. In Brisas del Norte, where roads are unpaved, and most people live in homes made out of scrap materials and tin roofs, relations between Colombians and Venezuelans have been good so far, but that hasn't been the same in other parts of Colombia. In Bogota, city officials recently had to remove posters from lampposts that told residents not to hire Venezuelan workers. Meanwhile, Mayor Claudia Lopez has been blaming Venezuelans for a rise in violent crimes.
Una minoría de migrantes venezolanos profundamente violentos son un factor de inseguridad.
There's a small group of migrants who are extremely violent and pose a threat to our security, Lopez said recently after a policeman was killed by a Venezuelan immigrant. She added that the Colombian government gives Venezuelans everything, but that there are no assurances for locals.
Can you imagine how it must feel for a Venezuelan to see that and see people just reacting to that and say, yes, of course, they're just rats and they're a plague.
Alejandro Daly runs a project known as the Xenophobia Barometer. Each month, he's finding Colombian accounts are posting around 40,000 xenophobic messages on Twitter.
We see that there is a strong correlation between news that link Venezuelan migrants and refugees with the increase of crime and insecurity in Colombia and the levels of xenophobia. Local media gives more proportion in their news feed to news relating Venezuelan migrants with crime than to other news around migration.
In this challenging environment, organizations that work with migrants in Colombia are no longer just providing legal assistance or helping with jobs. Some also try to change views about immigration. And in Riohacha, kickball has become a way to do that. The sport is largely unknown to Colombians who prefer soccer, but it's common in Venezuela where baseball is the main sport. The first to join the kickball league were Venezuelan migrants and their children. Slowly, locals also started to participate, including Jenny Ibarra, a mother of three from Riohacha. In this game, you don't have to run after a ball all the time, so there's more time to socialize, Ibarra says.
aprendió uno mucho su cultura, las clases de comida, por lo menos.
We've learned about the culture of our teammates, the dishes they cook, and how they eat black beans.
Uno, dos, tres.
So far, there are three adult teams in the kickball league, and four squads for kids under 14. UNICEF donated uniforms and equipment. And the national anthems of Colombia and Venezuela are played before championship matches. Volunteer coach Pablo Ochoa says that's fundamental. It's a way to practice respect for each other and teach positive values, he says. Gibel González, one of the team's captains, says adjusting to Colombia hasn't been easy.
Decían que las venezolanas venían.
They accuse me of coming here to take work away from Colombians, she says. It makes you feel bad. She says that the kickball league enables her to let off some steam and is also helping her to take her game to the next level. In Venezuela, we played casually, Gibel says. Here, I have a team with uniforms and regular practices. And for that, I'm very grateful. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Riohacha, Colombia.
In northern Ghana, there are villages where women are hidden. Many are elderly, in their 70s. They're in these camps because they're accused of being witches. But their voices can now be heard on a new album called I've Forgotten Now Who I Used to Be. All but one of the women had never played music or written songs before. They were recorded by award-winning record producer Ian Brennan and his wife Marilena Umahosa Deli. Marilena herself has a personal connection to witch hunting, which we'll get into in a moment. But first, Marilena joins us from her home in Italy. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Marilena, how did these women, and they are primarily women, get to these camps?
Well, these women are poor. They're elderly. They have been kicked out of their land by younger relatives who are very attracted by their land. And that land is all they own. So these women are very vulnerable. You know, they suffer from physical or mental illnesses such as Alzheimer's, senility, misshapen limbs, blindness. And they are completely exploited, they are stripped of their dignity, they are turned into monsters, they are literally stripped of their own land.
So these women are accused of being witches. What does being a witch mean in West Africa?
Being a witch is being a person that can cause harm to your crop, that can cause sterility. Witches are accused of doing harm to families. And, you know, Westerners often think that witch hunting is some ancient African practice, when in fact it's a post-colonial phenomenon that was imported by Westerners and that finds its roots in the rise of capitalism and in the witch hunting that took place in Europe, in America, during the Puritan era.
What are the living conditions for these women?
Well, the living conditions are not good at all. We are talking about women, human beings who constantly fear for their lives, but also that suffer physically or mentally. In fact, one of the things that we believe in is that more than giving food or closing witch camps, people should raise an awareness about these problems, senility, Alzheimer's, blindness, all kinds of physical problems that affect this community.
Are the women kept in these so-called camps against their will, or is it also partly a sanctuary because this is where they can live after they've been forced out of their homes and away from their families?
Correct. For these women, camps oftentimes are places where they can find a shelter and where they can feel safe. You know, they oftentimes wander homeless until they can find a village that will accept them.
So you and your husband, record producer Ian Brennan, you invited these women to sing songs and record them. How did you approach them?
Every case was different, but in general, I can tell you one thing, that we have been working in Africa for the past 12 years, and To locate some of the unofficial villages required passage down bumpy dirt roads and then being sent to the wrong village or in the wrong direction on purpose. Once located, the next step involved being vetted through a maze of elusive middlemen, each providing vague suggestions, shrugs, and denials, until finally an audience with the chief was granted.
So you had to get permission from somebody else in order to speak to these women. So they didn't even have the freedom to say yes or no.
Correct. It's not an immediate communication, let's say. It takes a few steps.
What was the recording setup like?
It was all recorded outdoors, and the record is composed entirely of instant compositions, often using objects from the immediate environment for instrumentation, such as tin cans, teapots, corn husks, tree limbs, and a balloon left over from a political rally, to name a few.
What do you mean by instant compositions? They were just composed on the spot?
They were improvisation.
Oh.
Yes.
The titles of many of the songs suggest pain and sadness. Titles like I Was Accused, Born Sick, and I Trusted My Family, But They Betrayed Me.
This song is a mantra. The women say words over and over again, like in this case, and they sound like prayers. They're just pure emotion.
As I mentioned earlier, you have a personal connection with witch hunting. What is that?
My own mother is a disabled widow, immigrant, a genocide survivor from Rwanda, and is the same age as most of these women. And we grew up poor, and it is impossible for me to look at these women's circumstance and not see my own mother and an inhumane fate, but for a matter of geography, could as well be hers. And a member of my own family was driven out of her village in Malawi as a child after she was accused of being a witch due to having a white father, a fate that could have been my own if our places of birth were simply swapped.
Hmm. It's incredible. I think most Americans think of, you know, witch hunting and witch accusations as something that goes back hundreds of years. But there's been variations on it up to the present.
Absolutely. You know, in July 2020, a 90-year-old woman was lynched and 17 other women were slated for execution by the same witch hunter. So these women are risking every day their life. They risk to be tortured. They risk to be kicked out of their land. They're totally exploited. And it's a very current problem.
The album is I've Forgotten Now Who I Used to Be. It was recorded by Marlene Umohosa-Deli and her husband Ian Brennan and features the voices of so-called witches in hidden villages in northern Ghana. Thank you, Marlene.
Thank you. Come on, aye, aye, come on, aye, aye. Come on, so she, aye, aye. Come on, aye, aye, come on, aye.
That's all for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman's back in the host chair on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend. Come on, come on, so she,